And now,
the definition. Definition.
In Atlanta, where he was raised as a minister's son, Dr. Martin Luther King seeks to pursue his dream of Negro equality through nonviolence. His leadership has been challenged, and so has his dream.
The black man in America is saying in substance that either you solve this problem and make freedom a reality, or you annihilate us. This is the choice that America has. Either exterminate us or make it right for us to live. And that it boils down to just that. So, and I don't think that America has degenerated to the point that it will seek to exterminate the Negro. So I think white America is going to eventually adjust to living creatively and brotherly with the Negro. But I do think that we will have to work a long time to get even the English language to the point of really recognizing the Negro or the black man as a man, because everything black in our language is considered low and worthless and inferior and degrading. If one would thumb through Roget's thesaurus, you would see 125 synonyms for black, and they are all negative and low and degrading, and 118 synonyms for white, and they're all high and pure and chaste and everything else that you would consider high, noble, and good. But in spite of this, I think that a strong, vigorous, determined movement can force the whole society to begin the process of accepting the Negro as a fellow human being, a person, and as a man.
Is this not black power you're talking about?
I guess that is, in the sense that it is a psychological call for manhood. Now, I've made it clear that I believe in the concept of black power if it means that, a psychological call for manhood, where the Negro is not ashamed of his heritage, he's proud of it, and where he is not ashamed of being black. He comes to see that there's nothing wrong with being black, and black is as beautiful as any other color. And if it means an amassing of political and economic power to achieve our legitimate goals, I can go for it altogether. Unfortunately, the slogan black power has some negative connotations, and those I can't go with. Certainly I can't believe in black separatism, and often this is one of the connotations, and I can't go along with violence. And unfortunately, some who have used violence and who engaged in riots have shouted black power in the process. A riot ends up creating many more problems for the Negro community than it solves, and for the larger community. And certainly you can't establish brotherhood through violence, because it only intensifies the fears of the white community while relieving the guilt. You can, through violence, burn down a building, but you can't establish justice. You can murder a murderer, but you can't murder murder through violence. You can murder a hater, but you can't murder hate. And what we are trying to get rid of is hate and injustice and all of these other things that continue the long night of man's inhumanity to man. But I find that even the other groups that are preaching violence are willing to go along with nonviolence if they feel that something is being gained through nonviolence. And this is why I say that the power structure often aids and abets the few forces that are preaching violence, because the only time they will make concessions in many instances is when Negroes riot, and then they make a few token concessions and give the Negroes the impression that the only way you can get anything in a northern community is to start burning the town down.
What is it about the Negro? I mean, every other group that came as an immigrant somehow, not easily, but somehow got around it. Is it just the fact that Negroes are black?
The fact is that the Negro was a slave in this country for 244 years. That act, that was a willful thing that was done. The Negro was brought here in chains, treated in very inhuman fashion, and And this led to the thingification of the Negro. So he was not looked upon as a person. He was not looked upon as a human being with the same status and worth as other human beings. And it seems to me that white America must see that no other ethnic group has been a slave on American soil. That is one thing that other immigrant groups haven't had to face. And so emancipation for the Negro was really freedom to hunger. It was freedom to the winds and rains of heaven. It was freedom without food to eat or land to cultivate, and therefore it was freedom and famine at the same time. And when white Americans tell the Negro to lift himself by his own bootstraps, they don't look over the legacy of slavery and segregation. I believe we ought to do all we can and seek to lift ourselves by our own bootstraps. But it's a cruel jest to say to a bootless man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. So that I must say that white America must assume the major responsibility for the Negro's dilemma today. The Negro's dilemma grows out of white America's dilemma. We've got to recognize that the black man is the key figure in America now. You either deal with this problem in America, or America can bring down the curtains of disaster and doom on its own civilization.
While we battle nonviolently to end the disaster of inadequacy in education, it must be conducted as part of a larger interrelated struggle. I refer to the urgent need to move beyond opportunity to achievement. Until the Negro can be released from economic privation, he cannot be deemed fully liberated. Negroes are still at the bottom of the economic ladder. Our affluent nation is experiencing a complex manpower revolution, dramatic shifts in the composition of labor force, increasing rapid technological change, and rising educational and skill requirements. At the same time, automation is eliminating jobs from our economy at the rate of 40,000 per week or 2,080,000 a year, while technological forces and structural unemployment brought about by automation are colorblind. The objective economic position of the Negro in society causes him as a group to be hardest hit by automation. They are chained by the lowest rung by a double lock. One imprisons them on the basis of color, while the second binds them to a culture of poverty. And poverty in America tends to be concentrated among disadvantaged groups. Negroes in America are unemployed the longest, have lower earnings when they are employed, and have less education on the average, benefit less financially from the education they do attain. While we make up only 22% of the overall 9 million poor families, one half of all Negro families in the United States are poor by the 3,000 annual income definition. In 1962, almost 33% of the non-white workers had not completed elementary school, as compared with 10% among whites. A fifth of non-white and a third of whites had finished high school. In 1959, the median annual income of all the white population who had income was $3,207 a year, whereas for Negroes it was slightly over $1,518. The average Negro with 4 years of college education can expect to earn less in his lifetime than the white eighth grade dropout. The Negro today is not struggling for some abstract, vague rights, but for concrete and prompt improvement in his way of life. His struggle for rights is at bottom a struggle for opportunities. In asking for opportunity, the Negro is not seeking charity. He does not want to languish on welfare rolls any more than the next man. He does not want a job that he cannot handle. He does not, on the other hand, want to be told that that is no place where he can be trained to handle a job. So with equal opportunity must come practical, realistic aid, which will equip the Negro to enjoy the opportunities available. Today, special measures are needed to alleviate the economic conditions of Negroes and all other persons in a family unit which earns less than $3,000 a year. I'm proposing, therefore, that just as we granted a GI Bill of Rights to war veterans, America launch a broad-based and gigantic bill of rights for the disadvantaged, our veterans of the long siege of denial. The bill I am proposing would directly attack the broad economic front, the disadvantage of the nation, our 9.3 million families who are earning less than $3,000 per annum. The heart of my proposal is the declaration by law that $3,000 is the annual minimum subsistence floor of every family in the nation. All families earning less than subsistence floor would be required by the law to receive in direct payments the gap between a family's actual annual income and the subsistence floor. In addition, there must be a full program of free quality education and training, plus broad health service, so that the limited family income would not be expended for these essential needs. It is of the essence of this law that an extensive creative effort be made by the agency which is to administer the act to lift each family above the subsistence floor. One must look upon this as a challenge analogous to that which faces the public health service when it attacks an epidemic in a community. They locate all infected, they relieve the pain and suffering, they cure the sick, and they eliminate the source of the infection so that it may not recur. An additional and decisive fact confronted the Negro and helped to bring him out of the houses, into the streets, out of the trenches, and into the front lines. This was a recognition that 100 years had passed since emancipation, with no profound effect on his plight. With the dawn of 1963, plans were afoot all over the land to celebrate the Emancipation Proclamation. In Washington, a federal commission had been established to mark the event. Governors of states and mayors of cities had utilized the date to enhance their political image by naming commissions, receiving committees, issuing statements, planning state pageants, sponsoring dinners, endorsing social activities. Champagne this year would bubble on countless tables, appropriately attired over thick cuts of roast beef. Legions would listen as luminous phrases were spun to salute the great democratic landmark which 1963 represented. But alas, all the talk and publicity accompanying the centennial only served to remind the Negro that he still wasn't free, that he still lived a form of slavery disguised by certain niceties of complexity. The pen of the great emancipator had moved the Negro into the sunlight of physical freedom, but actual conditions had left him behind in the shadow of political, psychological, social, economic and intellectual bondage. The Negro also had to recognize that 100 years after emancipation, he lived on a lonely island of economic insecurity in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. In the past two decades, changes in our country's economic structure have obscured the fact that the Negro's medium income is half that of the white man's. Negroes are still at the bottom of the economic ladder. They live within two concentric circles of segregation. One imprisons them on the basis of color.
while the other confines him within a separate culture of poverty. The average Negro is born into want and deprivation. His struggle to escape his circumstances is hindered by color discrimination. He is deprived of normal education and normal social and economic opportunities. When he seeks opportunity, he is so often told, in effect, to lift himself by his own bootstraps, advice which does not take into account the fact that he is barefoot. By 1963, most of America's working population had forgotten the Great Depression or had never known it. The slow and steady growth of unemployment had touched some of the white working force, but the proportion was still not more than 1 in 20. This was not true for the Negro. There were 2.5 times as many jobless Negroes as whites in 1963. Many white Americans of goodwill have never connected bigotry with economic exploitation. They have deplored prejudice, but tolerated or ignored economic injustice. But the Negro knows that these two evils have a malignant kinship. He knows this because he has worked in shops that employ him exclusively because the pay is below a living standard. He knows it is not an accident of geography that wage rates in the South are significantly lower than those in the North. He knows that the spotlight recently focused on the growth in the number of women who work is not a phenomenon in Negro life. The average Negro woman has always had to work to help keep her family in food and clothes. To the Negro, as 1963 approached, the economic structure of society appeared to be so altered that a precise sifting of jobs took place. The lowest paid employment and the most tentative jobs were reserved for him. If he sought to change his position, he was walled in by the tall barrier of discrimination. As summer came more than ever, the spread of unemployment had visible and tangible dimensions to the colored American. Equality meant dignity. And dignity demanded a job that was secured and a paycheck that lasted throughout the week.
As we stand at the threshold of the period of integration, we notice two contradictory forces at work in the South, the forces of defiance and the forces of compliance. The forces of defiance are at work in several ways. Many public officials are using the power of their offices to defy the law of the land. Through their irresponsible actions, their inflammatory statements, and their dissemination of distortions and half-truths, they have succeeded in arousing abnormal fears and morbid hatreds within the minds of underprivileged and uneducated whites, leaving them in such a state of excitement and confusion that they are led to acts of meanness and violence that no normal person would commit. We see a glaring example of this in New Orleans, Louisiana today. This defiance also expresses itself in the resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan. Determined to preserve segregation at any cost, this organization employs methods that are crude and primitive. It draws its members from underprivileged groups who see in the Negro's rising status a political and economic threat. And although the Klan is important politically and openly denounced from all sides, it remains a dangerous force which thrives on racial and religious bigotry. And that is always the implied threat of violence. And then that are the white citizens' councils. Since they occasionally recruit members from a higher social and economic level than the Klan, a halo of partial respectability hovers over them. But like the Klan, they are determined to preserve segregation despite the law. They base their defense on the legal maneuvers of interposition and nullification. Unfortunately for those who disagree with the councils, their methods do not stop with legal tactics. Their methods range from threats and intimidation to economic reprisals against Negro men and women. These methods also extend to whites who will dare to take a stand for justice. They demand absolute conformity from whites and abject submission from Negroes. The citizens' councils often argue piously that they abhor violence, but their defiance of the law, their unethical methods, and their vitriolic public pronouncements inevitably create the atmosphere in which violence thrives. And as a result of the council's activities, most white moderates in the South no longer feel free to discuss in public the issues involved in desegregation for fear of social ostracism and economic reprisals. And what channels of communication had once existed between whites and Negroes have thus now been largely closed. And certainly this is tragic. Men often hate each other because they fear each other. And they fear each other because they don't know each other, and they don't know each other because they are separated from each other. No greater tragedy can befall a society than the attempt to live in monologue rather than dialogue.
Class war. Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is your brother Vladimir Deese. Welcome to another episode of the Class War Battlefield Podcast. Martin Luther King is dead. Is it time to move on from him? This is a question that I have been wrestling with for a few years now. And it's a question that I think many black people, black human beings, wrestle with. I know that in the black consciousness community, there is an unequivocal yes to that question, which is sparked by even just the mere mention of the name Martin Luther King is usually met with derision within much of that community. And the reason for this is understandable. Individuals who claim to be conscious-driven black men and women, and I say claim not to demean them or to shortchange whatever they say, or to suggest that there is no legitimacy in what they say. I say it because Dr. King, of course, often spoke of consciousness, and throughout the spiritual path in life, consciousness is not limiting to individualism or to any one community. But I digress. They who consider Dr. King, consider him to be a traitor, consider him to be a person who spoke more about assimilation, which is what integration was about, for white people in the long run. Even I can see this. Even Dr. King started wondering about this towards the end of his life. But also that Dr. King himself saw more value in whiteness than blackness. And that Dr. King himself did not speak powerfully enough to save black communities. Indeed, he was blinded by his need to integrate black people into white America. He was blinded to the point where he didn't see that white America was destroying black communities in its effort to make real its manifest destiny. And in this analysis, they wouldn't actually describe it like that per se, but that is how I describe it. And that is how I've come to see Dr. King. But similar analyses, claiming that Dr. King cared more about white society than he did black society, somewhat rings true when you honestly look at his efforts. This is not to say that he was a bad person or to suggest that he was misguided. He saw his role as an intermediary between the two groups of people. And this did indeed sometimes blind him. But for most white people today, Dr. King is the patron saint of nonviolence. Very few honestly consider what Dr. King meant to the black community. Thus, Dr. King is a good person because he was seen to, or he is seen today, as he was seen years ago, as a respectable and responsible black leader. One who was doing right for black people by favoring white folks, by favoring and showing deference first to white genialities and genius, a person who, though he challenged white people, did not challenge them significantly enough to make them black people seem, in many or some ways, better than white society. So Dr. King is appreciated for this. He's appreciated for this. Yet, his nonviolence, which is touted as a success by white people, did very little to actually protect black people in the South. And white people tend to gloss over this. They also tend to gloss over the fact that black people in the South, whereas, yes, they did practice some nonviolence, there were many areas in the South that if black people stepped out outside of the normal customs. I'm not talking Bull Connor here, ladies and gentlemen. I'm talking about some of those backwood, backwater places. If black people stepped out of the normal customs, it wasn't going to make the news, but those black people disappeared. And so to protect themselves, these people weren't talking nonviolence. They picked up guns. And they had to. They had to. But Dr. King and, in general, the news media didn't cover those things, didn't talk about those things. And how could he? Because to suggest that these people hide away, essentially, and say, well, we're going to march and we're going to, you know, do good deeds loosen the heart of these people down here, would essentially been suicidal. So it was ignored. This is not to say that Dr. King would have accepted the violence and the use of guns that kept these people safe. He probably wouldn't have. It would have not changed the methods that these people took to ensure that they were safe. Hence the question that I posed at the beginning. Now, I am not one to ever say violence is the answer. But I think Dr. King presently, there is a crisis with his legacy. Because his legacy has been hijacked. His legacy has been sculpted to represent a very narrow, narrow view and vision of what America could and what America should be. Of course, Dr. King is revered for his I Have a Dream speech. Even conservatives can't knock that speech. The left worships his Beyond Vietnam speech, which is ironic to me, because as one professor pointed out, a white woman professor, many black college campuses, and actually I knew this from Malcolm X, so I want to give him the credit first. Many black college campuses, as early as 1961, were protesting against military activities on the campuses. Many people do not know still till this day that many majority black schools are targeted by the military and targeted by the Department of Defense for heavy recruiting. Heavy recruiting. That's why I often look with wary eyes at the statistics, which suggests that I think only one out of every four soldiers is black. Maybe soldiers, but I'm starting to think the support staff is more colorful than we are led to believe. That comes mostly from the fact that I do know a number of black people who have gone into the service as support staff. And Chalmers Johnson basically made that statement there is a hidden color code in the military that does perpetuate the supportive service role for many blacks. But they were protesting military activity on the campuses. They were protesting. They protested, of course, in the 50s, the Korean War. But they also protested in the early 1960s, the Vietnam War. Remember, Malcolm X made that wonderful statement, why am I going to go and kill Vietnamese when the Vietnamese have done nothing to me? And we have terrorists and people, of course, in this country, which need to be fought and dealt with here. So the war, the anti-war movement was not a white left invention. It was a black left invention that moved onto white campuses, which says something about the radicalness of black academia at that time. Dr. King, though, did not come out, of course, against the war until 67, when it was almost inconsequential, because many white folks had already started losing their minds and losing hope that the Vietnam War would win. So when he came out against the war, it was more palatable for him to do that. Now, the King Center has released a file which showcases a statement from 1965 from SCLC, which speaks about the organization's disapproval of the Vietnam War. But no member of the organization had actually come out forcibly and forcefully against the war. Dr. King changed that in 1967, and many of his closest allies, including many of those in SCLC, started backing away from him because they were now starting to see that he was on the downswing, and there was going to be a power vacuum left by his descendancy. So many on the left, many of white left, love that speech because it really pulled, they, I think, see Dr. King as being pulled more into the mainstream in alliance with them. He became more of a white leader to them. Whereas it wasn't about civil rights anymore, it was now about human rights, which put them at the forefront of his mind. This is the thinking, I propose, of many white lefties who see this. Now, many of them will not admit this. I don't expect them to. That's a psychological thing. But white lefties do not worship Martin Luther King but for two speeches, I Have a Dream and Beyond Vietnam. They do not worship him for, even though it is a damn good speech that most people have never heard, his Massey Lecture number 3, which absolutely eviscerates them and showcases their shallowness in their approach to actual, in their, I think approach would be a good word, to love. And the problems of them trying to emulate and digest the higher forms of love. It's a great speech. Now, when I say eviscerate, I really do mean he exposes them for their shallowness and their inability to take on the higher vibrations of love and turn them into something meaningful. This was, of course, published in late 1967, and many people have not heard of it, but I'm a little bit shocked considering most of the white left has significant resources, and if they were so inclined, if they actually did appreciate Dr. King, they would seek out these things, because as they well know, because they do seek out many other things. Noam Chomsky is a great example. Often the best stuff done by a person, the best speeches given by them, the best lectures, are not those that are readily available or readily published publicly. So they have to know that his best stuff is still yet to come, and I may still speak on that a little bit later. Anyway, so he's beloved because he became a white leader at that moment. And indeed, that is one of the things that I think ultimately led to his assassination. Many people fail to understand just how critical it was to keep him isolated in the black community, and how critical it was to keep him from uniting black people, not around a white cause, but a black cause. If one understands that the anti-war movement started not in the white community, but in the black community, then one sees and understands that the power of black consciousness rose to the heights of penetrating white dormancy. White people, because they had been I want to say because they had been soothed by the advances of the previous two decades, were pretty much apathetic to the world. And this was mostly the baby boomer generation and the generation before them. They were not a radical bunch. They were becoming increasingly conservative, and they were becoming indulgent in consumerism. And black people were being left out and were disaffected and decided, well, we're not going to take any of this anymore. And they started raising hell. And they started calling out the United States as they watched all across the world as other black folks rose up and gained independence and what have you. They started calling out the United States for its hypocrisy. And it seems that the nation then decided, mostly for international reasons, to start integration proceedings in order to tamp down the cries of their domestic black population. Well, when one sees a country, a nation, which not a nation, the United States is a country of multiple nations, but when one sees a country as a spiritual organism, which Dr. King did talk about, the soul of America, SCLC was meant to save the soul of America. If one sees a country as a spiritual organism with expanding and contracting energies that can either go up the scale or down the scale, one understands that multiple portions work towards multiple ends, and multiple cultures flow in multiple cosmic riverbeds. And so black people had always been on their own level, in their own wavelength, and they had scarcely ever penetrated white levels. And something happened in the 60s where that stopped, and black people dramatically penetrated white culture and white mentalities, specifically the white psyche. I like to think it had more to do with music, because black music just swept the country, and white folks specifically couldn't get enough of it, to the tune that, you know, basically every black person who made decent music could make a really decent, good living, especially in the burgs. But this power, this energy, which had been held in check by segregation, spilled into the white community. And as Dr. King mentioned in, I think it was Mesa Lecture Number 1, Massey Lecture Number 1, it was Number 3 also. Black people standing up gave white people the courage to do the same. Some for bad reasons, some for good reasons. Most, you know, for this conversation, it's the anti-war movement. And so the anti-war movement was a direct connection to the early black anti-war movement. And you have to think that studious white people in power saw this and made the connection and said, oh, we can't have this. We can't have this. We got to stop this. Dr. King in Massey Lecture Number 1 made a strange acknowledgement, seemingly, of this connection, where he spoke about a broader movement which had its roots and origins, which means it was radical, ladies and gentlemen. You've heard me say it before. Radicalism has to do with getting to the root of a problem. But he spoke about the movements in the 60s having its roots in the early revolutionary days of the United States. And as he pointed out, the first person to die in the Revolutionary War, supposedly, is Crispus Attucks, a black man. It is as if time moved and black people were repaying the favor, as it was, to reawaken white memory of, hey, remember what America is supposed to be about. And so therefore, that is when Dr. King crossed over and became more than just a black leader. He became a white leader also. This is evidence pointing to this. I was watching a video on YouTube, and I want to say it was the Mike Douglas Show, but I'm not sure. And it was this brilliant interview of Dr. King after he had done, he had actually spoken out against Vietnam War. And there was a question that was posed to him about not telling Negroes to fight in Vietnam. And this is a question that I had seen before aimed at Dr. King after his Vietnam speech. Why are you going to tell Negroes not to fight? And Dr. King said, as he always did, with great ease and carefulness and almost with a lightheartedness in his voice. He said, I didn't tell just Negroes not to fight. I think the war is so unjust that I believe all people of goodwill and conscience should not fight. This was a telling statement because, again, it wasn't a conversation a man who had his foot purely in the black community would have or was having with white society. He was now having a conversation with the multiple nations in the country. Further evidence of his moving from just a black leader to a white leader and beyond can be found in the group of people that he was talking about bringing to Washington, D.C. for his Poor People's Campaign. Dr. King, which, you know, if he had lived past all of that, because look, let's be frank, it wasn't, you know, they were going to chase all those people out of there. It might have taken a little bit of time, but they were going to chase him out of there. But he was talking about bringing poor Appalachian whites. Now, Appalachia had experienced dramatic, and excuse me for the cough, but they had experienced dramatic racism by poor impoverished whites against poor impoverished blacks. This was going to help to sew up that division. Imagine what it would have done for race relations if Dr. King had survived and had been instrumental in at least getting some reforms passed. Significant reforms passed that was going to help Appalachian whites. What would have come out of that when you really looked at black and white relationships? It would have healed those divisions almost overnight. This is dangerous because part of the strategy of the elite has always been to divide and conquer and to enable those wounds not to heal. Guilt is part of the healing process of dealing with those wounds. Anyway, Dr. King was looking to bring Appalachian whites, black people from the black ghettos, black people, middle class black folks, Native Americans. He talked about this in a statement he gave, technically it was a speech he gave, from earlier mid-March 1968. He talked about Native Americans coming out, Puerto Ricans and Chicanos, Asians, I gotta imagine. I don't remember him saying Asians on there, but I think in another speech I saw, he actually mentioned Asians. So he was becoming a true Rainbow Coalition candidate in person who was assembling all of these people together to try to push and move the consciousness of the country forward. This was frightening to those in charge. It was frightening because it made Dr. King, as I do believe Chris Hedges has said, and I am starting to truthfully believe this, a incredibly potent and powerful person. Because then it meant Dr. King himself, with a brilliant staff around him, which he didn't necessarily have at SCLC, there would have been much internal maneuvering after the Poor People's Campaign. Dr. King could have proved a formidable political opponent, either in 72 or beyond, if he even decided to run for president, or if he just decided to help form another party, which was something I wouldn't say he contemplated, but that was kind of what his Three Evils of Society speech was aimed at. So the left liking him for that reason is great, but it also downplays the core central reason why Dr. King was doing what he was doing, which was to alleviate the racism in society, which is something that the white left has not been very good at approaching and doing anything about. In fact, today, they seem more concerned with LGBTP or LGBT. I never can get the acronym right, but you know. With their rights than solving racism. And in fact, it seems that the white left is going to expend a tremendous amount of energy on a group of people which is going to benefit mostly white folks in making sure that they have something that they feel they are entitled to. Whether or not they are, doesn't matter to me, but they seem preoccupied with this and unwilling to still do something about the blatant racism, which is just rampant throughout this country at the present moment, and probably suggests that there is nothing ever going to be done about it, but I digress. This is one of the reasons why I have come to ask that question over and over again. The short answer, I think, to that question is complex. Dr. King obviously lived at a certain time period, and he spoke needfully on issues which were beneficial firstly to white folks and then to black people. And he did this mostly out of belief that white people held the power to help black people help themselves. It wasn't as if he thought black people were inept. He just felt that they needed help from the bondages, the bondage and the circumstances which white people had actually perpetuated and created. But in doing this, he did downplay the intellectual ability of black people, and because he was educated in white institutions, he was unable to see what actual role white actions played in crafting the condition of black people and what those roles, what those actions, should I say, what counteractions really needed to be taken to reverse the state created by those actions. And so, Dr. King, his legacy must be approached from that level, or firstly, through that lens. Should we move on from it? No. I think Dr. King has a lot to teach us. But I think it is time that we stop questioning whether or not we need to follow Dr. King, and specifically for black people. We need to stop questioning whether or not we need to follow Dr. King. Or do we need to follow Malcolm X? Or do we need to follow Marcus Garvey? Or do we need to follow Huey Newton? Or do we need to follow John Hendrick Clark? I leave out the greatest of great, I think, because I love this woman, and that is Assata Shakur. Do we need to follow any of them? I think it's no longer down to should we follow any of them. I think it is, do we need to follow all of them. And whereas this is not the forum to speak on how that should be done, black people, most notably, need to follow all of them. Dr. King, in general, is a person who offers the world a tremendous ability to love and unite and forgive. And this is really why he, I think, was a threat. More so than any other, he had a clarity of mission. A real clarity of mission. And that mission was to unite and to heal. Marcus Garvey had an amazing clarity of vision to help black people. We now need both to unite. I exclude Malcolm in this analysis because Malcolm was an extension of Marcus Garvey. So I just go straight to the source. It is interesting to note that Martin Luther King, if certain speakers are to be believed, was Well, actually, I guess it's not even certain speakers are to be believed. I've seen the some of the evidence of this. But Martin Luther King was moving in the direction of Garveyism. At least the idea of uniting African-American black struggles to African continental struggles, and to bring in the economic forces of the black American and the African, the black African together. And this too made him dangerous, made him significantly dangerous. When one considers, and I never can remember which president suggested it, but there was a president, I believe it was in either South America or Indonesia, who suggested that the third world colored countries required a massive state apparatus similar to that of the United States and the Soviet Union to protect their interests. A personality like Dr. King, who was both willing to champion black independence and interdependence among its people, but also cooperation with conscious, driven people of European descent, of South American descent, of indigenous descent, all across the world. That is a powerful persona. It is a powerful avatar to build from. And so he offers us the ability to do all of that. And to explain, and this is something that is amazing to me still to this day, to explain the logical need and the spiritual need for black power and black action, separately from any need of any other action concerning white people. There are things that black people must do for themselves, by themselves, to aid in the liberation of their minds and their bodies and their hearts, which are necessary, and would not leave them oppositional to white people. Dr. King explained this. There's a great article which he wrote, which I'm still surprised I haven't found it as a speech, which it just reads like a speech, called Black Power Defined. And if you've never read it, go and read it. You can find it. Black Power Defined, Martin Luther King. Type it into Google. You'll see it. It is absolutely fantastically amazing. Absolutely. And Dr. King still offers us that clarity. And in that way, his contribution to our modern circumstance is that foundation of love, unity, and healing. Before I end the show, though, I want to add, you know, one more point. And I made it earlier. Whereas his legacy offers us that love, unity, and healing, his legacy also challenges us to reach higher than his legacy. So in that way, we have to realize he is dead and that his legacy stopped growing when he died. I know most people would say, well, his legacy was carried on by this, 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 and this, and this. I don't necessarily believe that, because very few people actually seek to live out the basic message of the peoples whose legacies that they carry on. And for various reasons, they don't do that. But we have to understand that
Dr. King came from a time period where black people were just awakening. And Dr. King himself spoke simplistically, but if you listen to his words or read his words, you'll realize that he talked in code. And a lot of what he was speaking about was aimed at something higher and brighter. Therefore, in order to live his legacy, in order to do something, not live his legacy, that's contradictory, isn't it? But in order to do something positive with that legacy, to build off of it, because it's one of many stones that you can place in black foundations, in order to build off of it, we have to accept this and realize that, yes, while he spoke a lot about integration and he's talked about integration being originally a thought of the good aspects and attributes of both sides united as one, that he was imperfect, and that whereas we look at it as assimilation today, Dr. King himself did not look at it as assimilation, though he was blinded by the movement forward to indeed integrate. He didn't see it as assimilation, and yet by the waning year of his life, he started seeing it more and more as assimilation. In Testament of Hope, a compilation of many speeches and transcripts of Dr. King's, there is a posthumously released essay that Dr. King wrote. And he speaks about the concern of major black cities ringed by almost entirely white suburbs. Indeed, when I say almost, I'm not talking like 80%, I'm talking 97, 98, 99, and in many cases 100%, so all white suburbs. And this, although I don't know, I don't believe, should I say, I don't remember if he used the word assimilation, but this reeks of assimilation. So he was consciously aware that this was indeed happening. But by that time, it was almost too late for him to do anything about it. So we have to remember this. We also have to remember that the majority of Dr. King's work, and I mean this, the majority of Dr. King's work has never been published for public consumption. I have read through probably half a dozen books, and looked through several more than that, of Dr. King's life and philosophy and what have you. And what is evident from those books when you look through the notes at the end is that Dr. King wrote far more than what most people know him to have done. Indeed, recently over the last couple of years, I know we've all been kind of fascinated with the fact that multiple speeches unknown have been discovered. And as I've often said to friends of mine when discussing this issue of Dr. King's material being available, most people, when they see that, it triggers in their subconscious this idea that everything Dr. King has ever done, written, or said has been released to the public, when in fact, that is far, and I do mean far. I mean, you're standing in New York City, and you're calling somebody in Japan. That is far from true. That's far from true. These things are being discovered, yes. Yes, and thankfully they're being released. But the majority of what the man actually did has never seen the light of day. Has never seen the light of day. And to be honest with you, you can check this if you want. And I encourage you to actually check this. I have read through probably 100 speeches and sermons of Dr. King. And specifically in the 1950s and the early 1960s, I was stunned to see that many of the speeches I was reading were officially released by the King Center. And in the description given, there's a description at the top of the PDFs that I was downloading, or the Word documents in some cases. They have a description of the speech, and then at the end, they'll say, the following transcript was taken from an audio recording. And then they'll give the speech or sermon. And I was shocked by this, because then I would go and I'd say, oh my God, okay, so I can obviously get this online. And so I would go and I would do research. I was spending sometimes hours looking this stuff up. And what I discovered was a lot of these transcripts, you can't get the audio version of them. You cannot get the audio version of them. And many of these are incredibly important speeches. They have more to do with the philosophical underpinning of Dr. King and his legacy than some of the actual speeches that were released and have been widely circulated. To give you just one example, Dr. King gave, actually, I'll give you two of them, and they're really two of my favorite speeches. The first one, Dr. King gave in front of the SNCC organization, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And it is called, if I remember correctly, Love, Law, and Civil Disobedience. This is a amazing speech, which really does a lot to position Dr. King's philosophy of going against unjust laws and obeying just laws, and how he viewed the importance of black youth activism. It's an incredible speech. You can get the entire transcript online. Love, Law, and Civil Disobedience. And on that transcript, it says this has been taken from an audio recording. This, I believe that one was from, I'm not really sure. I want to say it was 61 or 62, but I'm not sure. But I was shocked to find that you cannot get that audio recording. You can't get it. The second speech, which is, again, when you talk about Dr. King, there are two phrases and words that automatically should jump into your mind. The first one is nonviolent. The second one, some people probably would argue Gandhi. Not me. Love. Love. Most people love and admire his speech, love your enemies. They love that, especially white lefties and some conservatives, because basically it's, you know, you shouldn't seek to hate that which is oppressing you. But there's another incredibly powerful speech that Dr. King gave. I do not know, I cannot say that it was, that he recorded it, or excuse me, that he gave it prior to this date. This is the earliest that I found this speech. And it's called The Levels of Love. And that one was given in 1962. And this traces the many levels of love that Dr. King would actually reference throughout the years. This is a powerful and important speech, which, as a person who spoke on love all the time, you would think would be publicly available for consumption. Another speech, which I'm not sure if there is a audio recording of it, I did send away to the University of Chicago to see if I could get my hands on any information pertaining to it, but I found nothing. I received an email basically telling me that they were unable to confirm anything or what have you because of copyright and legal issues, which falls on the King family and King estate. But Dr. King delivered a speech, and I really think it was in response to another speech, which I think it was a black sociologist gave, which was tailored on the black family in America. And it was a tremendous speech. Tremendous speech. One that should be available. I would imagine it would be available via audio, although there is no confirmation for that. And then lastly, a speech which I know, because I've got this one confirmed years ago, is existent in at least video form, is a very detailed and long speech. And I mean long. You can get this one on online. I was going to say on a website, but I'm not 100% sure if it's on the website. And it's this speech Dr. King gave in front of, and pardon me if I get this slightly wrong, I think it was the APA, the American Psychological Association. But it was an association of psychologists. There's likewise a speech Dr. King gave in front of the New York City Bar Association. But the APA speech, I know because I talked to an archivist familiar with Dr. King archives, who said, yeah, there's a tape of that, or, you know, there's tape of that, where it's the whole speech. And this is a dynamic speech, which, again, would add to Dr. King's legacy. The New York City bar speech also would add to his legacy. So, you know, there has to really be an effort. And I've been brainstorming some ideas on that effort, but, you know, there has to be an effort to really get all of what Dr. King was about out to the public, because it's needed. It has been needed for decades, but it's really needed now. And there are literally, I've done some of the research on this, there are literally almost at least 100 audio speeches and sermons that have not seen the light of day from Dr. King. And I say almost at least because it is slightly below 100 presently, and these are counted, these are known to be in existence. Actually, considering, I did not necessarily count in, because I have a list, a running list that I keep, so I didn't necessarily count those that were on, that were transcript. I just went into his archives and researched what was listed as audio. So there might well be over 100 now, but there are, you know, things being uncovered each and every single day. We need to push the King Center, even if we have to do a national fundraising campaign to put the money into their hands. We need to push them to really put his legacy forward and put all of these things online so people can watch them and listen to them, and I'll be honest, download them. You know, I know Dr. King is not as revered as he once was, but with this new influx of material and information and a really new millennium analyses, I think he will be. So I want to thank you all for listening. I want to thank you all for, you know, giving me your time of day. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, please, please, please don't hesitate. Send me a message. Thank you very much. I will see you next week. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and they're alive.